Hello, and welcome to Long Time No See, the podcast. Each week, we'll be pairing two blindfolded comedians who've agreed to sit down with a mystery guest. I'll be putting them on the spot with a series of questions about their careers, lives, and opinions. Without further ado, please remove your blindfolds and introduce yourself.
Hey, I'm Michael.
Hi, Andrea.
I have to be honest with you, I am so relieved to see a Jew.
Do you have any irrational fears? What's the worst fad you were into? Is there any job that you would be terrible at?
Underwater welder?
Don't say that about yourself.
Do you guys have any useless talents?
I kicked one of those delivery robots.
What? You kicked one?
Yelling. I kick those all the time.
They have names on them.
Good.
I can make smoke come out of my mouth with nothing.
Do it.
You want to see it?
What the f***? Are you a dragon?
Out now, Long Time No See, the podcast, season 2. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
To find out what's really going on behind the music, sometimes you have to dig deep. I'm Dr. Mike, and on the new season of Going There, we're doing just that.
Art or music can be your escape and your therapy.
Going There is the podcast at the crossroads of music and mental health, where we have raw, meaningful conversations with artists like Noah Kahn, Julian Baker, Jason Isbell, Youngblood, The Head and the Heart, and Bishop Briggs.
I recently heard someone describe grief as glitter, where you'll clean it up and then you'll find little pieces.
By opening ourselves up to these real discussions about mental health, we can foster understanding and gain even greater appreciation for the music we all love.
For me, like, my favorite songs give me happy tears.
So join me and some of your favorite artists on the new season of Going There with Dr. Mike, brought to you by Sound Mind Live and the Consequence Podcast Network. Subscribe wherever you listen to your podcasts.
So you want to be a rock and roll star? No? Well, how about a podcast star? Well, as it turns out, there's a new all-in-one platform just for you. It's called Anchor, and it's the easiest way to make a podcast. And check this out, it's free. There's creation tools that allow you to record and edit your podcast right from your phone or computer. And then Anchor will distribute the podcast for you so it can be heard on Spotify and Apple Podcast and, you know, everywhere else in podcast land. And what's even better, you can actually make money from your podcast. Go figure. No minimum listenership on that. It's everything you need to make a podcast in one place. So go ahead, download the free Anchor app right now or go to anchor.fm to get started. So what are you waiting for? Podcast stardom is within your reach.
Do you read Stephen King? Good news. There's a club for you. The Losers Club. And guess what? You don't have to die at the hands of a shape-shifting clown to join. No, all you have to do is tune in every Friday as us losers journey through the never-ending wastelands of King's Dominion. Each week, we'll either spend hours reading between the pages of one of his books or chew on his latest tweets and Hollywood headlines. What's more, we're always having guests over. Thomas Jane, Mick Garris, Jerry O'Connell, Mary Lambert, Will Wheaton, and the list goes on. So what are you waiting for? Join us as we read on through long days and pleasant nights.
Consequence Podcast Network.
Welcome to another edition of Kyle Meredith With. It's an audio interview series presented by WFPK, Independent Louisville, Consequence of Sound, and the Consequence Podcast Network. Wherever you're listening from today, go ahead and hit the subscribe button that's right in front of you. If you can leave a rating or review, do that as well. I'm Kyle Meredith, and today my guest is Dave Weindorf of the band Monster Magnet. There's a lot of anniversaries happening that we get to talk about, including the 25th anniversary of Super Judge, the 20th anniversary of their mega album Power Trip. In fact, we'll talk about the big hit Space Lord that was on there and how the video to that holds a pretty cool little stat, keeping them tied in as the first video ever played on TRL. One of their songs is also now the name of a very famous Marvel superhero. We'll talk about that and also discuss their brand new album, Mindfucker. It's Kyle Meredith with Monster Magnet.
How are you, Kyle?
I know you've got a monstrous new record with Mindfucker, no pun intended there, but it's a beast of it, man. It's a powerful record. Congratulations.
Thanks,
on that.
Dude. Yeah. Thank you.
There's actually three different eras here that I want to hit on today because there's a couple of big round anniversaries. I usually like to give my guests the the first flip on where to go in the time machine. If you want to start in 93, 98, or 2018.
You just pick one. That's fine.
let's go chronological. Let's head back to 93 first, because you got this great record, Super Judge, that's actually celebrating its 25th anniversary this year. And I kind of wanted to touch on that one, because at the time, that was sort of an overlooked record, right? Like, that's found its audience since then.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely. It came out. It was our first record on a major. And it definitely wasn't the record that the major wanted. You know, I'm sure they wanted like they were expecting probably like a bigger sounding record. And what I gave them was basically this kind of like rot gut, almost like demo sounding. Me trying to be, me afraid of appearing to sell out too soon after signing to a major. Really, that's what that was about. So I tried to make this nasty sound, and then I think I made it too nasty. So it came out, and it was noticed by the people who knew about Monster Magnet, but not too much past that.
I know you guys had toured a little bit with Soundgarden before that, and maybe I was just reaching for it, but I could sort of hear, I mean, you guys, you know, kind of came from the same rock family anyway, but I could hear a little bit of that same sound in there. I didn't know if there was like some mutual influencing going on.
Probably. I couldn't imagine. I was a huge Soundgarden fan. And so, yeah, you know, I mean, a lot of tempos and stuff. They inspired me with tempos, their slower tempo thing. And they were, you know, I'm sure they were pulling from the same stuff we were, was like old Zeppelin and Psych, you know, anything that was like hanging around at that point that was 10 to 15 or 20 years old that no one had really thought about for a while.
Well, I mean, and of course, it can't be overlooked that rock had become a new thing at that point. You know, we're talking about 93, so obviously, you know, the grunge explosion is starting to happen or is in the middle of happening, and the attention was different. Did you feel at all, though, that you were a part of that in any version?
A little bit. I guess as much as you can if you're from New Jersey. You know what I mean? You're from New Jersey, you're pretty much like wearing the hat, whether you like to or not. But I was certainly inspired by the indie rock boom, you know, which means it was a do-it-yourself time where the do-it-yourselfers were starting to get as much press attention as the big record labels were, which is amazing. I mean, that never happened before. So you got these little record companies like Sub Pop, which were little at the time, Amphetamine Reptile, and on, all these little record companies that were getting press attention. And it looked like a whole brand new world of, like, guess what? We can, like, change the rules, or we don't have to obey the rules. Because the rules up until that point, and probably always had been, it had been more of a corporate rock thing. Like, you bust in with the corporate rock guys before you get any press. You know, that's it. Right. No one's going to know you outside of your town until you sign with us. And this kind of broke the rules. There were fanzines everywhere. It was really good on independent press, and printing of fanzines had got cheaper. Printing had changed. Kinko's came around. You know, that was a day where it was basically information. It was like pre-internet. It was a cool time. So I felt part of it in that respect. But, you know, no, I didn't feel like I was part of the Seattle scene, because that was about as far away from Seattle as you could get culturally and still be in the United States.
Right. Well, jump back in there, because, of course, you know, it's a Power Trip. I mean, that is still just one of the all-time great classics. And it's become your all's calling card in a way. It came out in 1998. You guys had been around at that point for about almost 10 years. And it finally happens. I mean, did the success, it must have felt hard won when that finally arrived like that.
Yeah, you know, it felt hard won, and also felt like a surprise, because I honestly didn't think that anyone was ever going to get what Monster Magnet was about. And even though I kind of tightened it up and put it in a context that more people could understand, I really didn't think I had like, you know, struck it commercially. So I was really surprised that people responded to it like they did. I mean, basically, it was a record that was a response to record company guys telling me that we were all over the map, you know, musically. We've been with different records each time. Like, one was more psychedelic, one was more like a kind of weird psych punk rock. There's nothing that the radio audience could grab a hold of. And and I'm like, you know, man, I got to tell you, I never really thought I was going to even get this far. I wasn't prepared to all of a sudden, you know, retool the, you know, Monster Magnet to be this, you know, to be whatever you guys would like it to be. So maybe you made a big mistake in signing us. You know, I mean, if you, you know what I mean? If you want Pearl Jam, there's plenty of Pearl Jams
right,
out there.
Right, right.
And, you know, because that was the stuff that was really hitting the radio. You know, it was Pearl Jam, Stone Temple Pilots, stuff like that. And we were weird. It was different. But I remember saying, like, really cynically, oh, you guys, you can't sell this stuff. You could sell anything. If they could sell a million pocket combs, you know, every quarter in the world, you could sell Monster Magnet, at least a million of them.
Right.
Maybe all I should do is like put like beautiful women on the cover and dress in shiny suits like the rap guys. So maybe I should just do that, huh? And just call it rock, rock, rock and put on leather pants. So then I went home and I was like, wait a second, why don't I do that? I've got nothing to lose. I've been around for 10 years. And that certainly still fits into the criteria of my favorite music, which was, you know, I make no bones about it. I think the best time in rock was probably around like 69 to around, you know, like, you know, like say 65 to about 75.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, I think it really hit a big peak. And plus, I was a kid, so you kind of never lose your influences. So I was like, yeah, that's what one of those psychedelic bands would do if they were around for 10 years. If they started off psych, they'd probably wind up wearing leather pants and shooting fire. So I did that, and it worked.
And it worked.
It freaked me out. I was like, holy, I can't believe it.
Well, you know, you listen to a song like, you know, and I'll hit on Space Lord in a minute, but Temple of Your Dreams, like that guitar part, I don't know, you put it in a different pedal and it's nearly a pop song. And maybe that was also a little bit of Vegas in there, because I feel like you can hear Vegas in that one.
Yeah, I think so, too. I mean, I wrote the thing in Vegas. So, yeah, in order to make everything perfect, I was like, OK, I'm going to Vegas to write a record. Like, this is what the record's going to be about. It's going to be about the American dream, my American dream, where, you know, I'm pretty cynical about this stuff, where it's money first and, you know, content second. You know, my whole thing was with the record company was like, you just need a better cover on the thing. You know, I was totally cynical to what people wanted musically, or, you know, just me making fun of advertising culture. So go to Vegas and do it right. Do the whole Hunter S. Thompson thing, Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, and do that. And it was a dream come true for me to actually have somebody pay me to go to Las Vegas to, you know. It really was like the whole American dream come around. It, you know, life is weird and getting weirder.
You're hitting on our hometown boy right there. Hunter's a Louisville boy, so I was lucky.
Oh, yeah, Hunter, man. What a, like, probably one of America's quickest, finest writers ever. The guy wrote like a diamond razor. I've never read anyone's prose that's so crackling in my whole life. It's amazing. You know, regardless of what anybody thought of him politically or whatever, I mean, the guy was just absolutely fantastic.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, he's one of the greats, man.
No,
I mean, he's right up there. He's a great American writer.
I mean, we got a town that's got one of the greatest writers and then the greatest of all time with Ali. So, you know, we're proud of all of our exports.
Yeah, really,
anyway.
Forget it. I mean, just go back. The ghosts alone will beat you away unless you agree.
Well, back on Power Trip, because, you know, of course, with all this, you got to bring up Space Lord. When I listen to that now, I think with everything going on, is that an acoustic guitar at the beginning of it, or just an electric to sound like an acoustic?
Oh, that's acoustic, yeah.
So that was really, I mean, okay, so Alice in Chains were doing a little bit of that, and even another Louisville export, Days of the New, had a little bit, but that's still really against the grain of people's expectations of your band and what we're going to expect from a big rock song at the time on the radio.
Yeah, I guess so. You know, I wasn't thinking about it that way. I was just thinking of, like, what's a way to get the listener in rather than beat them right from the get-go, because I definitely noticed that a lot of times our songs were so loud that it would tend to be they tend to drone when they're placed next to each other. You know, you have one loud song, another loud song, another loud song. It's great live, but if you put on a record, sometimes you tend to zone out, and it's almost like you flatline in your head. I was like, what's a way to follow a loud song with another loud song without that droning thing? And started off really, really low. You know, I think it was kind of popular at the time. I think other bands might be doing it, maybe not with acoustic, but the quiet to loud thing.
Oh, sure.
Anyway, it was kind of a bluesy riff, so it fit in perfect.
And I've read, I wanted to make sure it's true, first video ever on TRL?
Yeah.
Is that true?
Yeah, that's what I think. That's what I heard.
That's an interesting place in pop culture history right there.
Yeah, and again, with the whole cynical thing, I was like, you know, we're going to do this video. You know, they're like, oh, you know, what would you like to do for the video? The record company was cool. They didn't tell me what to do, but they would express their fears. They'd always come and go, like, well, what kind of video would you like to do? And me being you know, on this cynical bent on this thing, was it's like, well, it's really easy. You can have an artistic one, which I've got in my head, which is totally cool and beautiful, or you can have the one that'll probably get picked up. Well, can we have the one that's picked up? And I was like, yeah, it's really easy. Just copy a rap video, click. That's what I did. I just then hung up, and then they went and hired. You know, I was like, could I have, like, the guy, who's the guy that makes the most popular rap video? Like, whoever it is, I don't even care who it is. Just make them do that. Just put, you know, put a bunch of white trash New Jersey guys in rap suits, and it'll be huge. Because no one had done it then.
Right.
It was like before Kid Rock was doing his thing. And I just thought it'd be really funny. And it worked. It was amazing.
I remember it so well. I remember, like, not just seeing it now. I remember those first few times seeing it. And, you know, it's just instantly drawn in. The visuals were bright and shiny, and everything that was, you know, glowy about that era. And the song was catchy as hell.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, how hip-hop and those hip-hop videos at that time really set the standard very, very quickly for videos forever. You know, I mean, for a short time when the grunge thing came out, MTV, and this is, you know, when MTV mattered and all this stuff, and stuff doesn't matter anymore. But at the time, it was really important to catch people's eye. And in hip-hop culture, especially the Hollywood, not the artists themselves, but I really think it was kind of like a cabal of directors, really more than the artists.
Completely.
Designers, directors, they had just constantly refined as the big money came into hip-hop, because hip-hop was making more money than anything else, so they had more money for videos. They had the freedom and to spend a lot of coin on refining this look, that kind of silvery, shiny, at that time considered like totally HD before HD, like super, super shiny, beautiful videos. And that commercially, that just went right to everybody's head, you know, and kind of blew everything else out forever.
Right.
They're still making videos like that.
I do want to cheat here and ask about something out of these anniversary times, only since we're in the 90s. But Negasonic Teenage Warhead, I mean, that had been a minor hit before Power Trip and eventually became an X-Men character, right?
Mm-hmm.
What was that like for you?
Totally cool, bizarre. And as usual with something in my life, it's like things come out like satellites that go around a planet. That satellite went out like, what, 20 years ago and came in and hit me in the head 20 years later, like, doing Negasonic Teenage Warhead. Yeah, that happened because a really, really cool guy named Grant Morrison, one of the most talented comic book writers in the world, 20 or so years ago, happened to give us a shout out by naming a minor X-Men character Negasonic Teenage Warhead. It was a throwaway character. And he just did it. And back in those days, you know, he just did stuff like that. There was no, you know, call for, like, permission or anything. He just went and did it. And it came out. And I was like, wow, that's really, really cool. And, of course, the character went away. It was a minor character. Flash forward 20 years later, and Marvel's a big movie company, and I guess the director for Deadpool is going through characters that he can use in his movie. You know, they can't share all the characters. So he's going to have to look through a list of minor characters so he can use it. You know, it's not appearing in the Avengers. I can use this character. And from what I hear, he just picked it on name alone. He's like, this is a goop. What's this goofy name, Negasonic Teenage Warhead? So they reinvented the character for that. And the next thing you know, she's like kind of a breakout in the movie.
Yeah. I mean, first off, it's a fantastic name, a great title for a song, and really works well for a superhero. Does the attention come back to you for that? Were they able to connect the dots? Do you actually see a return?
Yeah, somewhat. I mean, not as much as I would love to. Like, you know, I called Marvel and stuff, but they just acted like I didn't exist. Oh. Yeah, well, I think that, you know, they get a little funky around about copyright. They probably thought I was coming to, like, sniff out some money. Things get a little squirrely there when, you know, it's a title. It's a title that I created. Mm-hmm. It's a title that they had published without permission. And now it's in, you know, like 500? I think it's way above $500 million gross
right now.
So I would imagine they wouldn't want to get into it.
At least just a big old wave, you know, just some acknowledgement.
That's all I wanted was a shout out. I swear, though, I was like, just please, like, you know, get one of your schmiedels in there to just go, hey, this is Marvel Comics. We love Monster Man, but nothing.
License the song, you know, just that's it. Just license it.
I know. Well, I'm still waiting, and I figure, like, rather than go on the internet and be a big crybaby,
right?
I'll just like kind of let it pass and enjoy whatever I can enjoy from it.
It's totally cool. It's another good moment pop culture for you. Kind of a running theme.
Hell yeah.
Here.
I mean, there's been a couple. I like it.
Yeah. Well, let's get into 2018 then, because Mindfucker gets released earlier this year. It's a relentless record. I mean, like I said, just keeps pounding away. You've talked about, you know, tackling shorter songs this time around, right?
Yeah, I wanted to do, you know, this all came really from a desire to get some songs, since live is so much more important now than it ever has been before for a life of a rock band. I mean, since, you know, the actual music is not making bands a lot of money, you know, and that's a whole other story. But basically, yeah, the musician's worst nightmare came true. Your music is almost worthless. You know what I mean?
It's right.
So that means that live is going to be everything. And so that means I play live more than I ever did, which is amazing because I always played a lot. And I just got to one point after doing a couple really long-form psychedelic records going, I'm going to need more live songs for the set. I need to make a rock record. I got to shorten these songs up and be able to, like, switch them in and out, you know. I need to have something that's going to pound people without redoing, you know, every hit every other time. You know, it's got to be fresh. It's got to be new, and it has to be new songs, and they have to be able to work right from the get-go in a live situation. And that's where the record came from.
Yeah, I mean, out of the gate, you get Rocket Freak, and it's like, it's sort of a Stooges kind of a sound to it, right? I mean, this is,
yeah,
this
there
is
all
rock.
Detroit. I love Detroit, that kind of stuff. There's certain chords, man, you know? There's certain chords in rock that are so timeless to me, and they just keep coming back to me, and they work in any almost form. I mean, I could slow it down and make it all psych, and the chords would work, but tightened up and done at a fast tempo and with a little extra, like, sing-songy on the top of it, mm-hmm. you know, kind of push, like you say, pop. It's almost pop. Or it pop in a way that could more describe an older pop. Basically, memorable melodies on top of cool chords. That's all it is, you know. That's really all it is. But I needed lots of it. You know, I needed, like, a set. So I wrote the record as much as I could as a set of live music. You know, I sat down and wrote the songs almost in sequence.
Wow.
The first five songs were written as the first five songs of a set. So I sat down, okay, what would the first song be? It might be this. Dun, dun, dun. Oh, that sounds cool, you know, just by feel and tempo and stuff. And then I got to about song five, and I started to break down and started failing. But it worked. The theory worked pretty good, because now I can put the record on and go, yeah, I could see that played live. And sure enough, we do a lot of that.
That's awesome.
Come out and do like the first three songs, at least three or four songs in a row.
Well, then thematically, of course, it's an angry record for an unstable time. You talk about the information age. You talk about the information age in the 90s when no one was really putting the actual title to it. You were sort of doing the broad stroke of that, saying this is what's going on. This is the bigger picture. And now we're here. This feels like this album, you know, in music, feels like the result of that conversation.
It definitely is. It's also the result of somebody who can't keep his mind off, you know. I'm just like, it's a result of somebody who, which is me, paying close attention, probably more attention than it's healthy for me, to information and media and how it affects culture. It was always really important for me to understand why I like stuff and why I didn't like stuff. And why, when I was a child, beyond just being the love of things when you're a child, why I enjoyed music and rock culture so much. And that was because it was almost untouched and was left in a world of its own. The older people who signed this stuff, you know, in the 70s, they didn't understand it. They knew they could make money off it. They just couldn't understand it, so they just signed it. Rock culture kind of made up its own mythology. It made up its own thing. It operated politically when it wanted to. It operated apolitically when it wanted to, but it was its own thing. As I got into the 90s, when I grew up, you know, it was in the 90s, I was in my, you know, late 20s, early 30s, I noticed that everything started, the beast, you know, of commerciality and the beast of advertising had started to just drive almost everything artistically in the same direction. And the words to describe it were, you know, were still the same. People were still using the same jargon. Oh, this is cutting edge. This is wild. This is crazy. This is new. But I noticed this stuff, it wasn't new. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. They're just using the same jargon. So things got more homogenized. And here we are today in a time where you would think that with internet democracy that there would be the most craziest, wildest, biggest experiment ever. No. You know, hey, that's not. It's probably like the worst time for music. There's way too many bands that sound the same, and we're just kind of floating on there. I think everyone's just stunned by information overload and almost like intimidated by the amount of information rather than inspired by it.
Was the information action ratio? I heard the fellow from the Arctic Monkeys talking about that the other day, but the information that you get in and how much it actually is important to you that you can use versus all the information. I mean, because everything, you don't know if what you're reading is true or not anymore.
Right.
You know, if you're not keen to look at exactly the actual address it came from, do the research on where the writer was getting its sources. I mean, anything is so easily manipulated.
No, you're absolutely right. And you know something? It always was. There was just more time to figure it out if someone chose to. Mm-hmm. Now, because of the rapid fire, you know, this, you know, 25 hours a day broadband internet, it seems as if there's more information than ever. There's actually, it's the same amount of information. It was just never up there in the same spot before. And it seems like there's less time for us to figure it out. And it sets a pace that's impossible to keep up with, that's for sure. It's nuts. I mean, that's what Mindfucker, you know, that's where Mindfucker came from. And a lot of the stuff I sing about there is, you know, this is just balls out crazy. And it's crazy for anyone to really try to think they can ride that horse. You know, I mean, obviously, when you have a situation like this where it's so unstable and so many people could be confused, who do you think's going to win?
Right.
The bad guys.
Right.
The bad guys are always great at that.
We've seen those movies. We know that story.
We've seen the movies. It's so crazy. But yet, here we got a nation of people, like on one side or the other, picking heroes and villains. They only want heroes, villains, and victims. Mm-hmm. They completely forgot that people are human beings. All the shades of gray. There's not enough time for the shades of gray on the internet. You're either a hero, a victim, or a villain. And that's just not true. It's never true. You know, it's almost like the country will never get a national consensus anymore because they're so busy fighting over their identity. They're finding it. They're like, this is my identity. And I was like, wait, you didn't even explain your identity. You just like something on the internet. You just joined someone else's club, you know? It's just like, again, it's probably narcissism. This is me. I was like, look, if this is you, then what kind of person are you that would just spend all their time yelling at somebody else for any reason? You don't know what's going on. Crazy times.
Yeah.
Like, these are the times where I'm a big history buff, you know? These are the times where people get so bamboozled. They get so fed up that at one point there'll be a tipping point. Everyone will just give up. You know,
yeah.
And maybe things will settle down. I don't know.
I center on in your song, I'm God. How does that fit into the conversation that we're having right here? What's going on in it? Because that's a big song.
I'm God was just, I mean, it's a pretty symbol. I wrote this thing in the week of Trump's inauguration. And I didn't want to. I just happened to schedule to write the lyrics to the songs in there. And I was like, I don't want to write about this. But I did because, you know, as a writer, you have to write what's on your mind. So God was just, hey, I wonder what God would think about this. He'd probably look down and go, you know, I gave you guys like a million years. How many years has culture been around? 3,000 years, 4,000 years? I mean, civilization. And you couldn't have better examples of which way misinformed hatred, you know, in politics, misinformed lying hatred, just balls out hatred and lies. They don't usually wind up too well. You know, if you look back in history, none of these people that have ever talked this way, no matter how idealistic as possible, I think if there's God, he'd probably fire you. He would fire us.
Uh-huh.
Get out. Or I'm leaving. You know, I gave you guys enough chances. So I'm God. I'm riding a river of flame and I'm thinking of saying goodbye. Goodbye. You had your chance.
If the,
so that's what that song's about. Just like, what would he do? He'd probably like treat us like kids and go, all right, you kids figure it out. I'm going to go to another dimension somewhere.
The great failed experiment, humanity.
You know, you're not the only planet I worked on. I've got another planet on the other side that you guys don't know about. They're doing fine. You idiots want to, like, roll back the clock by 50 or 60 years, even longer. So, like, we're behaving like we're in, like, the 19th century.
That's what I appreciate, because you're sort of a sociologist. I mean, you are. You're a sociologist as a musician, and it always comes out in these lyrics, and I think that's what I've always latched on to when I'm listening to Monster Magnet.
Oh, thanks. Yeah. I can't help it. I mean, if that's I was raised, you know, myself being a huge fan of writers, as well as music, but as of writers. Hunter S. Thompson, Tom Wolfe, all those new journalists, you know, all that stuff. And older writers as well. Like, you know, I just love writing, and I love the ideas of trying to capture whatever the spirit was of that time. And since I'm not a field sociologist, I just have to go by myself. You know, I have to go into myself and just write it. I try not to spend too much time in the actual writing of the words and just let it out.
Well, I'm definitely a fan of it. I appreciate it. I appreciate the conversation, Dave. I should also mention before I get off of here, Monster Magnet, you guys are going to be in town in Louisville for the Louder Than Life Festival, and you are playing on my birthday, September 30th, so it's going to be a fun day.
Damn.
Yeah, look at that.
I haven't been to Kentucky in years, man.
Yeah, it'd be good to have you back. Really will.
It'd be, you know, like you say, Thompson and Ali.
That's right.
That's enough for me.
Yeah.
I mean,
we will see you down here. And again, congrats on Mindfucker. And thanks, Dave, so much for this conversation today.
Thank you, Kyle. Take care.
It's been
man.
A pleasure. Take care. Bye.
Right on. Bye-bye.
Big thanks to Dave Weindorf of Monster Magnet for giving me the call. The brand new record is called Mindfucker. Don't forget, you can subscribe to Consequence of Sound's YouTube channel to keep up with your favorite artists and interviews. If you're listening to the podcast, iTunes, Podchaser, or wherever you're getting it from, go ahead and give it a rating, leave a review, and then head over to WFPK.org. That's where you hear me do a show every Monday through Thursday from noon to 3 Eastern. You'll also find some bonus episodes of this series over there as well. I'm Kyle Meredith. I'll see you next time.
Consequence Podcast Network.